So the same chemicals that are released when we're legitimately scared are released when we're scared in the theater. But what happens when we're in the safe confines of the theater, those same chemicals, instead of preparing us for threats, can actually feel good.
That's Dr. Brian Sharpless, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Dr. Sharpless is a licensed clinical psychologist, researcher, and author who does science outreach via public lectures, workshops, and media appearances. He joins us to talk about Monsters on the Couch, the real psychological disorders behind your favorite horror movies. Dr. Sharpless, welcome to Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan.
Well, tell us about the inspiration for this book. Obviously, this is part of your profession, but have you always been interested in movie monsters?
Yes. Even when I was a little kid, I was seeing things. I probably shouldn't have been watching it even 6 or 7 or 8. So, yeah, I mean, one of the big parts of my profession is researching rare and unusual disorders. And several of them clearly overlap with major themes in horror movies and horror movie monsters. So when I had a bit of time to play with, I decided why not put these two interests together, like chocolate and peanut butter.
Tell us a bit about the book. How is it organized?
Yeah, it's organized according to movie, monster, and disorder. So I start out with talking about vampire movies and real vampires. So not like the Dracula on the screen, but people who actually have the strong desire and feel the need to drink human blood. Not for nutritional reasons, generally for sexual reasons. Then I go into werewolves and zombies, which are classics. A lot of people don't know there's a disorder called Cotard syndrome, where you actually believe you are dead and you're essentially a walking corpse. Then I go into some of the newer movies. So we go into Nightmare on Elm Street, which is a complicated tale that involves the Vietnam War and Laotians. It would take us all our time just to get into that. Then we get into Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which people are very surprised to learn that the delusion that you believe important people in your life have been replaced with identical looking duplicates that are inferior, it's actually very common. It's found in 7 to 10% of patients with Alzheimer's. So if you work with elderly populations, as I do occasionally, you run across this disorder. And then last but not least, we hit a couple themes that are more the darker side. We get into cannibalism and necrophilia.
So much to cover, so little time. But let's go back to the classics, which you start the book with. And so let's go back to vampires. Tell us a little bit more about the real world mental disorder that makes people want to consume blood.
Yeah, it's very interesting. As you can imagine, not a lot of real-life vampires want to come in and be studied by skeptical psychologists. But we do have a number of case studies, especially in the criminal literature. So usually people come to the attention and get researched and written up for case studies when they have run a bit afoul of the law. So real vampires, it's interesting. They start with a typical progression. And very few people go from 0 to 60 and just start drinking other people's blood. It usually starts out by drinking one's own blood. So we call that auto-vampirism. And that can happen purely by chance. You accidentally cut yourself and you end up pairing the taste of blood with other things that can be problematic. Then typically what happens is people then drink the blood of animals. So there's a famous case that was written up where a boy who had been drinking his own blood was sitting on a porch one day and he saw a dog get hit by the car. And he immediately rushed out, not to comfort the poor dying animal, but to scoop up a handful of the animal's blood and drink it. And he described the sensations that he felt. And people will describe it as sexual. People will describe it as euphoric. People will describe it as almost having a sense of oneness with the universe and feeling really powerful. And then typically only after you've hit those two stages do you move on to drink the blood of other people. And what might be surprising to some of your audience is sometimes that's purely consensual. Not everybody is going around and treating people like beer kegs and just stealing their blood without permission. But some will engage in consensual relationships with people. There's a book written by Laycock, and he talks about vampires, particularly in Louisiana, where they have a good number of folks that practice vampirism, consensual vampirism. And he did a little bit of study on those folks.
Well, another classic monster that we see are werewolves. What can you tell us about that?
Yes. I actually just wrote a paper with a colleague in the Netherlands where we went through all of the scientific literature, even going back to the 1600s, of people who believe they turn into different animals. Wolves are not the number one creature, but dogs are. Wolves are number second. But there are cases of werecows, cases of weresnakes. But my all-time favorite was the case of a weregerbil. So a gentleman, very suddenly, when he was in the throes of a manic episode, he started crawling under furniture. His nose started twitching in that cute way that rodents do. And he was sleeping under his bed. So he very suddenly went from, you know, being fairly high functioning to believing he was an animal. He also, strangely enough, raised gerbils as a child. But there are several famous cases, going back to the 16th century, of people who believe they turned into wolves, and they sometimes commit violent acts against others. So I visited the archaeological site where Gilles Garnier lived. He was called the Werewolf of Dole, and he killed several children back in the 16th century.
And another classic monster, of course, zombies. And you, as you mentioned earlier, there are conditions where people actually believe they're dead.
Yeah. And they have what we would call nihilistic delusions. So they might believe they're dead. They might believe they're trapped in hell. The most troubling descriptions you hear are people who believe that their bodies are rotting from the inside. They can actually feel themselves decaying. And strangely enough, these folks are at a very high risk of suicide, right up there with depression and borderline personality disorder. And you might wonder, well, how does this make sense? You know, somebody who believes they're dead is at risk of suicide. Well, it only makes sense if you realize these folks don't think like we do, and things can be true and not true at the same time. So they have other cognitive disturbances that might lead them to think, well, I'm dead, but it's eminently reasonable to try to kill myself. So when you're working with those folks, you have to constantly assess for a risk to themselves. And that, as you can tell, ties into some of the zombie movies. Probably my favorite zombie movie is Return of the Living Dead. And in that movie, it's unique for being the first American film to have fast zombies. It's also got a great punk rock soundtrack, so I'm a big punk fan. But it's the first movie that describes zombie motivation. They eat brains because that gives them temporary relief from the pain of being dead. And so kind of similar to how Cotard's people can be aware and hyper conscious of what they feel are disturbances in their body, like they're rotting, is very similar to that movie. And these folks are very troubled by it.
Well, as you mentioned in another section of the book, you delve into movies like Nightmare on Elm Street. And there's so much going on there because, of course, people have nightmares and they're frightened. So tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, Wes Craven is a genius because what he did, he actually took newspaper articles and turned it into a fantastic horror franchise. So back in the early 70s, a bunch of Hmong men from Laos who had fled the Khmer Rouge following the Vietnam War, because they were our colleagues, they were helping us, helping America during that. They started dying suddenly in their sleep. And these were very healthy people. Some of them were trained medical professionals, and they were dying suddenly in their sleep in their 30s. Very unusual. And there were reports of people screaming. There were reports of people having hallucinations, people just suddenly stopping breathing. So this got a lot of press attention, probably because it was given a name that kind of resonates with people, called sudden unexplained nocturnal death syndrome. It's a mouthful, but that's going to get press attention. So Wes Craven read about that and worked it into Freddy Krueger. And what we found out, and this took decades of scientific research, East Asian men are very prone to a genetic abnormality in their hearts, and they're prone to get Brugada syndrome and things like Brugada syndrome, which are electrical conduction problems in the heart. And where it gets interesting is these can be triggered by extreme fear. They could be triggered by real nightmares. It could actually be triggered by just eating a heavy meal before bed. And the terrifying thing about Brugada is you could go see your cardiologist and you get an EKG and they give you a complete clean bill of health. You could die that night from this. Unless they know to look for Brugada and are specifically looking for it, it can easily be missed on good scans. It's an interesting way in which psychological things like nightmares, or another disorder I study a lot is sleep paralysis, which I'm guessing some of your audience have had in the past, very scary nocturnal things could serve as a trigger for bigger problem in your heart and could actually lead to death. So you're not scared to death, though that can happen at times. It's extraordinarily rare. But most people are not scared to death, but they serve to have hyperventilating episodes, which leads to releasing a lot of chemicals, which ends up triggering these scary heart conditions. And so Wes Craven became a millionaire based on that. And I will also say he named Freddy Krueger after his childhood bully. So you want to be careful who you bully unless you want to be associated with a serial killer.
Well, that's just a taste of some of the analysis you have in the book. But I'm curious also about just sort of the function of horror movies, because a lot of people enjoy going to the horror movies and being scared. So what purpose does that serve for our mental health?
Well, not everybody likes horror movies. I certainly do. But what happens in horror has been described by another author as hijacking the fear response. So the same chemicals that are released when we're legitimately scared are released when we're scared in the theater. But what happens when we're in the safe confines of the theater, those same chemicals, instead of preparing us for threats, can actually feel good. And they can actually lead to feelings of closeness with whoever we're with. So if any of your audience members want to increase their chances for a second date, take them to a horror movie for the first one, or take them on a roller coaster ride, because those same scary neurotransmitters and hormones will end up making us feel good and close. And plus, it's a safe way to really confront issues we don't usually discuss, like our own mortality. I'm guessing if your audience is like most people, they don't spend a lot of time on a daily basis thinking that they will not be here someday. But I and many philosophers and many psychologists would say that's really to our detriment. We don't want to be preoccupied with death like Woody Allen, where we can't function. But we don't want to ignore it either, because death serves as a stimulus for life. And I think through identifying with characters who are at mortal risk and are facing scary things and overcoming scary things, that's another piece. We always root for the underdog, and we always want to overcome the things that terrify us, the things that cause us problems. So I think those are some of the reasons we like horror. And plus, horror has always been a really transgressive kind of thing. It hits taboos. It hits topics that you don't see in many comedies and you don't see in many rom-coms, for instance. It really hits tough areas. And there's a subversive element. You look at some of the fathers of horror, they're covering really interesting things. Race relations, violence, conformity, communism versus capitalism. They're covering really heavy topics, but in a fun, subtle way. But if you look at these things with a more thoughtful lens, you see there's a lot of depth in horror movies. And I was trying to capture that. And, you know, selfishly, I like to make money watching horror movies.
Now, it seems like horror movies could be kind of a mixed bag in the sense, in regard to mental health, because it seems like it can teach us some things about mental health, but I'm sure the same hand, it also perpetuates myths and misinformation about mental health as well.
Yeah, it can certainly stigmatize. And I have in the last chapter of my book, I actually give advice for filmmakers on how not to do that, how to actually have a good interplay between psychology and filmmaking. And I think they both have a lot to learn from each other. Some very smart directors, apart from Wes Craven, have gotten inspiration from dusty old psychology and psychiatry journals. And so I think there could be a really good interplay. And I've personally used horror films to teach about mental health. But you're absolutely right. Certain horror films are very stigmatizing. And we can definitely entertain and talk about deep things without making life harder for people that suffer from things.
Well, there's so much more in this book we won't have time to talk about. What are some of the key takeaways you hope readers are going to get from the book?
Yeah. Watch more horror films would be one. Read more psychology. And there's a whole range of human experience that we just don't think of a lot of times, whether it's in terms of very rare manifestations of disorders that aren't as common as depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. and there are whole oceans of experience that we, you know, I think we should look at and learn from. The Stoics and other philosophical movements spent a lot of time thinking about scary things, thinking about death. And if we put that in a popular pop culture context, I think we can have a lot of fun and learn about the human condition and the things that all scare us and the things that make us happy. A philosopher professor of mine once quipped that if you really want to understand a person, you have to understand what they're afraid of. And I think there's a lot of truth there. If we know what we're motivated for in the negative, we can sometimes figure out what we're motivated for in the positive. I think it's a fun book, and I don't get too heavy with it. I try to keep it light and respectful and a little bit fun, and I make fun of myself a lot in it. So,
to learn more, the book is Monsters on the Couch: The Real Psychological Disorders Behind Your Favorite Horror Movies by Brian A. Sharpless. Dr. Sharpless, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. All the best.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.